Welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show. Kathleen's on vacation. I'm John Munson. In hour one of our program today, we'll talk about the massive problem of post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, among our nation's military veterans. We've lost more men and women from our armed forces to suicide than the combined number killed in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. The numbers are staggering. One of the questions we need to ask is why? And another is, what are we going to do about it? One former soldier has written a book on the subject. David Morris is a former Marine infantry officer who worked in Iraq from 2004 to 2007 as a reporter for Salon and the Virginia Quarterly Review. His story, The Big Suck, Notes from the Jarhead Underground, was originally published in VQR and was included in the Best American Non-Required Reading of 2007. His writing has appeared in The New Yorker, Slate, The Daily Beast, The Los Angeles Times, and elsewhere. In 2008, Morris was awarded a creative nonfiction fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts, as well as residencies at the McDowell Colony and the Norman Mailer Writers Colony in Provincetown, Massachusetts. A graduate of UC Irvine's MFA program in 2009, he won the Stage D. Blackford Award for nonfiction writing from the Virginia Quarterly Review. Well, what's more relevant today, he recounts his battles with post-traumatic stress disorder in a new book titled The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. And he joins me on the Kathleen Dunn Show this afternoon. David Morris, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So what was it that made you decide to write this particular book? What were you hoping to accomplish?
Well, it's a bit of a saga, but I guess the shorter answer is I began to experience some symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, and specifically what happened in 2007. I was riding in a military Humvee in a neighborhood in southern Baghdad that struck an IED, that struck a roadside bomb that was buried in some trash on the side of the road. And so I survived that experience, and then a few years later I was watching a movie, an action movie back in the States, and there was a situation in the movie depicted an IED ambush that was very realistic and was even shot from the same point of view that I would have had in the Humvee. And so when that happened during this action film, I actually sort of blacked out, and when I woke up, it was in the hallway of the Cineplex, and sort of wondering where the time had gone, and I was looking at people's hands to make sure they weren't carrying any weapons. And eventually I snuck back into the theater, and this hadn't happened to anyone else, which to me was sort of a wake-up call that I had some, that not all of my memories were under control, and that there were some things in my mind that I did not have mastery over. I'm a writer and a journalist as well, and so I began to look into this question of post-traumatic stress disorder. What is this thing? I mean, it's this very common component of our culture. It is sort of everywhere. In terms of if you look at the media out there and the coverage that it gets, people nowadays sort of assume that every veteran, if you went to Iraq or Afghanistan, you have PTSD. So one of the things I deal with in the book is the history of the condition, which was first recognized in 1980. So it's one of the fewest recognized psychiatric disorders. But sort of to step back a little bit and say, well, how did we, what do we know about it? What is PTSD, and how did people treat it or even think about it before 1980, before the Vietnam War and the protest movement that eventually fought for the recognition of PTSD?
Well, that's exactly where we need to go, though. I mean, what we now call PTSD started being recognized as what, shell shock in World War I? This isn't a new phenomenon; it's just newly diagnosed.
Right, and in the book, I take it even further back than that. I mean, there were every era of modern warfare had its own sort of version of post-traumatic stress disorder. And in the American Civil War, it was called soldier's heart or trotting heart, and in some cases nostalgia, which is a different use of the word than we might use it today. And then in World War I, it was referred to as shell shock. And then in World War II, it was referred to as combat exhaustion or combat fatigue. So you had all of these points in history when it could have been recognized by the psychiatric establishment. After World War I, there, you know, this is in the era of Sigmund Freud, and there was an awareness of this, the growing science of the mind. And there was an opportunity to recognize that after World War One, but it did not happen. And the reason for that is that the Vietnam War, where we do get PTSD, does emerge from the protest movement that rose up to oppose the Vietnam War. And the reason that we ended up with the diagnosis today that we have it is that a bunch of people on the far left, this group called Vietnam Veterans Against the War, the most famous member of which is John Kerry, our current Secretary of State. And this group of Vietnam veterans was very upset, very angry about the war. They felt that it was an atrocity-producing situation and that the war had turned them into animals, in their words. And they felt that there was no meaningful distinction to be made between the politics of the war, the bad morality of the Vietnam War, and their personal psychological problems. And so out of this protest movement, this attempt to end the Vietnam War, there became a growing awareness that not only did the war have a political fallout and a very serious political cost, which we're still dealing with today, but it had a very serious long-term psychological cost for people who fought in that war. And eventually, they were able to get this this idea recognized and operationalized into the Diagnostical and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or the DSM, which is, we're into the fifth edition of the DSM now, just came out last year. But that is the Bible of Psychiatry. And once you got PTSD into the Bible of Psychiatry, into the DSM, it was a victory for these Vietnam vets who were fighting against to end the war, because now, and for the first time in history, beginning in the United States in 1980, you had the opportunity for veterans and other survivors of trauma, like survivors of rape, people who survived natural disasters like tsunamis and earthquakes, to actually have a condition that they can have treated and that health insurance companies will recognize. And it's important to understand that PTSD is very, very new. It's as old as cable television. It's only been around since 1980. And so there's not a lot of the science behind it is still really kind of early and contingent. And we don't have a great handle on all of the various impacts that PTSD can have on an individual's brain and on their body and on their social existence.
Well, one of the things that we, as we're looking at evidence of PTSD's effects on military veterans over history, and obviously we don't necessarily have the kinds of statistics going back, centuries or anything like that, but we see a large percentage of veterans getting into trouble with the law for violent crime and things like that we didn't really recognize what the source of that was until more recent times. Isn't that true?
Yeah, and there weren't, and this is as much the case because the social sciences and there wasn't really, the social sciences weren't really as advanced and didn't have the same ability to collect data in, say, the 1700s, the 1800s. And the rise of academic social sciences and the military medical establishment was a product of World War One and World War Two. But to answer your question specifically with response, with respect to veterans and violence, there is a connection. It's very painful. I'm a former Marine officer. It's painful for me to say this, but there is a connection between PTSD diagnosis and what some researchers call antisocial behavior. And a lot of that is for some very specific reasons. And you have to consider the fact, and this goes back to all the way back to the prehistoric origins of what I look at with PTSD in the book, is that there have always been, whenever people go fight in a war, even back to medieval times, there was always a concern and there's always a deep-seated worry on the part of civilians who stay at home that soldiers will return and bring the violence back with them. And this is one of the reasons PTSD is such an important issue to address. The murder rate during the Vietnam War went up 107%. The murder and non-negligent homicide rate went up. So people ask me, well, why should I care about PTSD? The fact is, violence, there's a cycle of violence that is created. And when you expose, millions of young men to violence and get them habituated to it in the service of their country, there is a price to be paid. And one of the prices that is paid is what we refer to as PTSD. And, you know, I've heard people tell me, it's interesting, some people say, well, I think we treat our veterans rather well, and we give them, you know, kind of a Cadillac ride, and we give them all these benefits, and we spend millions of dollars at the VA to address their concerns, and I don't understand why. One of the reasons is that there is, you know, there is this concern that veterans, you know, do not, you know, if you come back from a war and if you served in the Army infantry or the Marine Corps infantry, you, your main skills that you've learned are how to kill, how to sleep on hard ground, how to march, how to disassemble your weapon, and manage the functioning of your weapon. But there's oftentimes a difficulty, and an understandable difficulty, for a young man who served 4 years overseas, did 4 deployments, and spent perhaps 44 months in Iraq. It's difficult to actually reintegrate and start your life over again. I mean, going to a war is a bit like, as I describe in the book, it's a little bit like time travel. You come back, society has changed, people look different, the clothes are different, the language is different, you've missed out on an entire swath of cultural references that you no longer understand. And it's very difficult, and generally speaking, the responsibility of changing and reintegrating yourself into society, that responsibility these days has largely been left on the shoulders of the veteran. And so one of the things we need to consider is not just PTSD as a psychiatric illness, but as a condition of liminality of the responsibility we have to greet veterans and to help them reintegrate and process the memories they had that they picked up from the war.
Well, you know, I guess when you think about it, the idea that we can train people to overcome the natural human revulsion for taking other human life, we train them to overcome that and to shoot at other people and to lob bombs and grenades and whatever at them, and then when they come back, they're just supposed to be able to turn that off and say, okay, I did that, we're all through with that now, seems really ludicrous on its face.
Yeah, and that's one of the underlying issues with the way the American and indeed the entire Western view of how the military works. Throughout history there have been rituals to address and to reintegrate people back into society. But we, interestingly, for whatever reason, in modern industrial America, there are no formal rituals that help people reintegrate back into mainstream American life.
Can you describe what you mean by ritual?
Well, for instance, it's fascinating. In New Zealand, they have the New Zealand Infantry Regiment has taken on this Maori, this Aboriginal tradition of the haka, H-A-K-A, and one of the things they do, and it's a funeral ceremony, but as the hearse that carries the coffin of their fallen comrade approaches their regimental area, they perform this ceremonial Polynesian war cry, and in which they and it's very it sounds ridiculous at first, but it's very honorable, and it's very cathartic, and it's very meaningful, and it brings me to tears almost every time I watch it on YouTube. And you can see this. There was a Clint Eastwood film about rugby, Invictus, that shows a haka being performed during a rugby game that is very similar to the haka that's being performed on YouTube. But it's a very these sorts of rituals are designed, and there are rituals throughout human cultures. They're designed to mark and to celebrate and to honor a transition of some sort. You know, be they a bar mitzvah or a quinceañera, and in this case, the haka ceremony that I'm describing is designed to honor your dead and to process the mourning of your fallen comrade, which is a central concern of someone who is returning from a war. How do I make sense of and how do I celebrate, honor, and outwardly show my feelings of compassion and love for my fallen comrades? So you know, rituals are something that we don't have. You know, America's a technologically modern country. We don't, and we've mostly shed a lot of the rituals that our ancestors had.
Well, I want to continue this discussion. We need to take a quick break. I also want to invite our listeners to participate in the discussion. We're talking about post-traumatic stress disorder, particularly as it affects our nation's military veterans. The suicide rate among veterans is just, when I saw some of the numbers, and we'll talk about those numbers in a little while, but they're just astonishing if you haven't been following this. And I must confess that I hadn't been paying as much attention to it as I probably should have been until this program got booked. But the numbers are really amazing and not in a good way. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about PTSD. We'll talk about what should be done and what is being done, what still needs to be done to help attenuate this problem. Probably never make it go away completely, but we sounds like we could do a better job of it than we have. My guest is David Morris, former Marine infantry officer who has also worked as a journalist in Iraq and Afghanistan. His new book is titled The Evil Hours, A Biography of Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. You can get in on the discussion in a number of ways. First of all, toll free at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Maybe you have a story of PTSD, either your own or that of a loved one, that you could share with us. Maybe if you have come through this and found a way to survive it and deal with it, maybe some therapy that you had or something that you used to help this. Or maybe you know someone, a friend or a relative who has come back from Iraq or Afghanistan or has suffered PTSD from some other trauma. Get a hold of us at 800-486-8655. If you get a busy signal, and I'm guessing our phone lines are going to fill up immediately, try our email address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And you can also find us on social media. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and Twitter. Leave your comment or question there. Again, 800-486-8655. We'll have more with our guest, David Morris, and with you in just a moment. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen. We're talking about PTSD this hour, post-traumatic stress disorder, with David Morris, the author of The Evil Hours, A Biography of Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. And he tells his story in the book. He's telling it to us on the radio this afternoon, and you can join us at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, talk@WPR.org, or the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and Twitter. David Morris, you were talking about rituals and their importance before we went to the break, and you were describing some rituals that were work. How do these? What's the importance here? I mean, it seems almost simplistic that there's some sort of a ritual that we could perform that would make a huge difference for someone going through this. Explain to me how this works.
Well, I mean, the idea is behind it that when soldiers come back from a war, the way we do it now, they go not on their own. They go with symbols of the United States. They go with soldiers. And the problem is when they come, you know, you enlist in the military, and then you go, you serve overseas, you put your life in danger, and it's all done under the rubric and under the care of your government. And then you're discharged, and you come back home, and all the problems and difficulties of adjustment are invisible, and they're all expected to be done by the veteran, who in many cases, you know, might be 21, 22, has not been to college, has held a few jobs, but he or she is largely expected to process this very complex, very challenging, very arduous experience of going to war. They're expected to do it all by themselves, and having a public symbol and a public recognition of their service and a recognition, and a symbolic, I mean, it seems sort of trivial. Okay, you have a ritual, but graduations and bar mitzvahs and quinceañeras, these things all have deep, deep psychological power to transform the way a person thinks of themselves and a way that the society looks at them. And so, you know, we think of this as sort of a ridiculous, you know, possibly a silly kind of thing, but We all go to graduations. We all go to weddings. We pay a lot of money. We go to a lot of trouble to enact these rituals because they help give the seasons of life meaning. And interestingly, even though weddings are a huge part of American culture, and so are wedding parties and the reception and bar mitzvahs and quinceañeras, all these different ethnic groups have their different rituals. But there is nothing that we do for survivors of trauma to greet them back into the world. And this is interesting because ancient societies tended to look, for instance, the ancient shamanic societies of northern Mexico tended to look at surviving trauma as being touched by the supernatural, as a mark of someone who is going to be a healer. And so there was always this, our relationship to trauma and war service and, you know, surviving a rape, for example, the idea that it has been medicalized and treated as a medical condition is historically unique. That has never happened before. We have only done this since 1980, basically, as a formal process. So we have 35 years in all of human history has it been treated as a medical condition. And so one of the things I do in the book is to look and compare and contrast and see what other cultures have done and what we can learn from them. We derive a lot of, so much of our lives are determined by these ancient wisdom traditions and these ancient cultural traditions that we call religion. And, the amount of meaning and identity and psychological power that is derived from someone, as a Catholic, as a Jew, as a Muslim, all of those great wisdom traditions that humans draw on can speak to these ideas that we call PTSD. And yet, for whatever reason, and that's traditionally how it's been done, the Catholic Church had a number of what they call penances for returning warriors during the early medieval period. They expected returning warriors coming back from wars in Germany and in Central Europe to come back and do penance for having served and possibly having killed. And they were expected to go through a confession process and deal with the moral costs of having served and having killed. And today we don't do that. Today when someone comes back from a war and they are dealing with symptoms and they feel confused and they're not getting along with their spouse or their loved one, what do? We send them to a hospital where people who are very smart and who have studied the issue for a long time but have never been to Iraq as a rule, have never been to Afghanistan as a rule, talk to them about their experiences. And so one of the questions I ask in the book is, why do we expect that physicians who deal in science and deal in hard, provable facts, why do we ask them to address what is on a certain level a very spiritual, moral, intangible, almost poetic or literary experience? Almost nothing is done to help the moral concerns of veterans who might feel really upset and challenged by the fact that they had to kill someone, that they accidentally had to shoot a child in Iraq. I interviewed an Iraq veteran who killed a young woman, a girl, and through no fault of his own, and so he has to live with that for the rest of his life. And yet, when his symptoms are discussed, it's more in a medical context with a young psych intern who probably doesn't really know much about Iraq.
Well, it sounds like, we've taken something which is extremely personal and moral and spiritual, and we've made it clinical, and we've tried to do what we normally do with things that are clinical. We either give someone a pill for it, or we stick them in a room with someone and tell them to talk about their problems, and then, at a certain point, we say, okay, that's it, you're done. That doesn't seem like it would be too effective.
Yeah, it's a start. A lot of it is, therapists, and people, researchers who look at this question will tell you that of all the possible therapies you can do, the therapies that the VA can do or any psychiatric hospital can do, is the most important factor is the relationship you have with that therapist. And in fact, some researchers did a study where they took a bunch of experienced therapists and said, okay, we're going to have you do what you do with these patients. And then we're also going to have some English professors that we train up on a couple of basic supportive counseling techniques, and they compared the two, and they found that they performed identically, that they both got good They both had good responses to the therapy that they went through. And so what that tells me is that if you go, if a very empathetic, good listener who sits with someone and gently and kindly listens to their problems and offers some solutions and reflects back to them what they think the patient is saying, just being heard and being feeling like you are understood and that someone else is bearing some of your pain has an extraordinarily therapeutic can have an extraordinarily therapeutic impact on a person. And if you think about it, that's not that different than what can happen between, in confession, to the religious example, between a priest and someone who is confessing.
We have tons of people who want to join us by phone. I want to see if we can get to as many of these calls this hour as we can. We'll start in Richland Center, where Steve is on the line. Steve, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I really appreciate the guest's comments. I'm a physician, and I was in medical school in the late 90s. I was not aware.
Steve? For some reason, we lost Steve. Steve, I think you either got a bad cell or somebody pushed the wrong button someplace. Would you please call back, because yours was a thought I particularly wanted to capture. Let's go to Elena in Madison next. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. Hello? Okay, clearly something isn't working right here. We'll get the phone system squared away in just a moment, and we'll go back to our callers. David Morris, when I listen to you talk about rituals and how important they are, I'm thinking, you know, after World War II, soldiers got parades. Obviously, not everybody who got home got a parade the day they came home. But there was recognition of what they had done. They were celebrated. They were heroes. What a contrast to what happened when soldiers came back from Vietnam. And I'm old enough to have been around in that era. I'm not a veteran, so let's make that real clear. But I had a lot of friends who served in Vietnam, and I did speak with them when they came back. And I'll never forget, I took a 7-hour car ride with a Vietnam veteran who, as we were leaving Milwaukee headed for Superior, turned to me and said, "Listen, if I go to sleep, don't touch me." And then he explained later what he meant, because he said, "I'm likely to punch you if you touch me when I'm sleeping." And I had, you know, I was 18, 19 years old. I had no idea what that was about. And it wasn't until years later that I learned about post-traumatic stress disorder and discovered, okay, there's a reason for that. This guy had just come back from 2 tours in Vietnam and you know, great guy. We were on the debate team together. And, you know, but, you know, he tells me this as we get in the car, and I'm stuck in the back of this old station wagon for like 7 hours. And he says, "Don't touch me if I fall asleep." And then he promptly fell asleep. And I don't mean to make light of it, but at the time it scared the daylights out of me because I didn't know what was going on. And later, in later years, you know, I wish that I had known more, because I would have wanted to talk about that with him. But I guess what we're seeing is when soldiers come back now from Iraq and Afghanistan, from wherever we've sent them around the world, we're not just talking about maybe somebody who served 2 years and then got out, as we had conscripted soldiers we had in Vietnam and in Korea and elsewhere. We're talking about an all-volunteer force, multiple deployments, not just one or two, sometimes three, four, more deployments. And then when these people come back, we're just asking them, well, get over it. That seems like a recipe for a lot of problems.
Yeah, and I think to speak to your point about the World War II veterans, it's really interesting when you actually look at the research of who tends to come down with diagnosable PTSD and who doesn't. And one of the factors that plays into that is the perception of a positive homecoming experience. Like, you came back and your service was validated and appreciated and understood on some basic level. And a lot of and the major problem, as you just pointed out, was that in World War II there was a recognition. There was this huge wave of gratitude that American veterans were greeted with at the end of World War II. And importantly, at the end of World War II, because it was a draftee system and there was a huge conscript army, that there were more with so many veterans at home, there were simply more opportunities to be understood. for a returning veteran. There were people that you could go to, and you didn't feel like a Martian. You didn't feel like a weirdo. I mean, a number of one of the veterans I interviewed for this book was this young female Iraq veteran from Charleston, South Carolina, and she said she felt like a Martian because people, there were just, no one really understood. None of her peers could understand where she was coming from. She had experiences that were so out there and crazy and life-threatening and frightening to civilians that she didn't feel like she could share that experience with anyone. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, I mean, and in the book I talk about one of the interesting historical vignettes about PTSD is the group of Vietnam veterans that served with John McCain in the Hanoi Hilton, who were prisoners of war in Hanoi for, in John McCain's case, 5.5 years. And so this group of 547 prisoners was held for a very long time, endured some of the worst conditions imaginable for veterans. They were tortured over and over again and incarcerated, often in isolation, for years. And yet the Hanoi Hilton group has one of the lowest lifetime PTSD rates of any group that's ever been studied. It's about 3%, which is a fraction of the normal 12 to 15% that you see among Iraq and Afghan vets. And so the question is, well, what happened? Why such a low PTSD diagnosis rate? And a lot of it boils down to the fact that they were older and had been to college and had been highly trained. But they really are this unicorn in the research literature because when they came back to the United States, unlike every other Vietnam vet, they were greeted at the airport by their families. President Nixon in 1971 had run on a platform of getting these POWs, getting John McCain and the Hanoi Hilton prisoners of war returned with honor, and they were thrown a party at the White House. Frank Sinatra was there. Sammy Davis Jr. was there. They were given lifetime tickets to Major League Baseball, and most importantly, and this continues to this day, I've met people from the Hanoi Hilton that served there, and people, and there's this registry of them that you can access online, and these people have been studied, and their life lessons are transformed into like wisdom literature. And so you get this really strong sense that these people were some veterans that suffered and came back, and their experience was not only heard, understood, and processed, but it was indeed celebrated. And many of these veterans, particularly the Air Force veterans that were looked at in this one study, over half of them that lived in captivity at the Hanoi Hilton actually described it as a positive growth experience in the end. So, and a lot of it was just simply the manner and the ways in which they were greeted upon return. Many of them were given, like George Coker, returned to New Jersey. He was a naval aviator, and he was given the keys to the city, and was asked to address local women's clubs. And so, and I'm not arguing that every vet deserves his own individual parade, and that they should be given, you know, free Coca-Cola for life, but There is an important value to be an important exchange that happens when you thank a vet for his service, which I have to admit, when people thank me for my service, it does make me uncomfortable. It's not my ideal. It's a kind of an awkward situation. It's sort of like someone complimenting you on what you're wearing or something. But I think the more important thing that can happen is after you do that, if you're really interested, you know, whether you're at a bar or a ball game, you actually talk with that veteran and ask them where they served, what they did, and how long they were deployed, and get to know their experience a little more, not just this sort of blanket thank you.
We're coming up to a break, but I want to get this call from Chris in because I think he speaks to exactly the point you were just making. Chris in Wisconsin Dells, go ahead.
Actually, I'm not a he, but that's okay. I'm suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, and I wanted to say that people in the community, and I think maybe part of this is just that they have no comprehension of how to deal with it, and they be embarrassed about having to deal with it. They make things worse, but you just need to get over it, and you need to pick yourself up by your bootstraps and get on with your life. And if they had gone through what I have had to go through, they probably wouldn't be able to do this. So I have gotten to the point where I just basically hurl a euphemism at them and walk away and say, you know, when you get to the point where you can get it, because you're not getting it, then you can come and talk to me, because I can't deal with your judgments anymore, because the judgments on top of dealing with the other stuff is not helping and you're not being useful. So people need to learn how to be useful. And maybe your guest can talk about how to do that, how to get to that point where the people in your life are being useful instead of just being judgmental about it.
Thank you, Chris. David Morris, I want to get to that, but we really need to take a break right now. But when we come back, I want you to talk about exactly what Chris was talking about. How can we be useful? You got into a little bit of that, but I think we need to hear more of this. And then we'll try and get to the rest of our callers here before the end of the hour. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to The Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about post-traumatic stress disorder with David Morris, the author of a new book titled The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. And just before the break, David, we had a caller, Chris, who talked about her experiences and how people are often really not helpful in terms of dealing with what she has to deal with. That's not an uncommon experience, I'm guessing.
No, and in fact, I mean, one of the more common questions that I've had posed to me and is very common among Iraq and Afghanistan veterans is questions of the sort of that sound a lot like this. Did you kill anybody, or did you see any heavy combat? Did you see any dead bodies, or these very sort of almost, you know, obscene, almost pornographic questions? And I think there's a very good reason for that, why that happens the way that it does. And one of the veterans I interviewed, Clint Van Winkle, who wrote a very good memoir about his struggle with PTSD as an Iraq vet called Soft Spots, he was going to college in Arizona and kept running into that question. And he went to grad school in England. He had the chance to use the GI Bill to go to grad school, and he found, interestingly, that people did not ask him that question there. That there is something about American culture, and I'm being rather critical about this, is that there is something about American culture that makes us obsessed with violence. And we love, Americans are obsessed with guns, violence, and they have this lurid, almost obscene fascination with death that is somewhat unusual. And I think, you know, one of the reasons, you know, I argue in my book that one of the reasons I think we went to war in Iraq is that we love action movies. You know, we love American Sniper, and I don't think it's because we're really all that interested in vets. I think we're interested in guns, and we like the violence in the same way that we like pornography. We enjoy seeing this really – it's the same impulse that causes people to slow down and rubberneck on the freeway when there's an accident. It's one of the things that was one of the – that continues to disappoint me and disgust me about our country is that, you know, you come back and you serve your country and you've been through this awful experience, and – the really low quality of the questions and the really low, low common denominator of the conversations was a huge and continues to be a huge disappointment for me. I have not seen American Sniper. I watched The Hurt Locker finally after years, and I watched it in a very specific way so that it wouldn't trigger my symptoms, basically. I watched it backwards one scene at a time. But most Americans really love war movies. American Sniper is the number one film right now, and I think in America. And I argue that one of the reasons people love that movie so much is that there is this really lurid, and I personally think it's obscene, fascination with gun violence in the United States. And you see that. That is expressed rather clearly in the types of questions that veterans are regularly presented with, i.e., did you kill anyone in Iraq? And I'm just here to tell you, just for one takeaway, how to be more useful as a citizen when you're talking to a veteran is to not ask that question. It's one of the most offensive questions that you could pose. And that's not something it's not an appropriate question. Mm-hmm. I'll stop my criticisms of American culture now, but I think that's okay. Important thing.
Well, have at it, but we've got full phone banks, so I wanted to see if we can get to a few more callers before the hour is over, and we're rapidly running out of time. Elena from Madison has reconnected with us. Thank you so much for calling back, and go ahead.
Absolutely. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can. Go for it.
Good. I just wanted to say first, thank you. Second, my father was a Vietnam vet and had severe PTSD. We lost him to suicide a little over 6 years ago. And this is something that he struggled with his entire life. My entire growing up was colored by his experience and the fact that he really didn't have an outlet for it. And I know you touched on the Vietnam vets a bit, but we've since, you know, had an opportunity to look at his medical records. And at that point in time, what help he was given, not only was it mediocre at best, but he left thinking that he was a sociopath because they didn't have a word or a description or a diagnostic set for PTSD. And we all knew growing up as children, you know, don't sneak up on dad when he's sleeping. Like, don't sneak up on dad. If he doesn't know you're coming, leave a distance between the two of you because he could turn in some kind of a fight stance because it was so reflexive and ingrained. And when he passed away, one of the things that my sister and I looked at was, well, how do we turn our tragic experience into something positive for other families, not just for veterans, but for the people who live with them? And I was thinking I would volunteer with a group, and I even called the VA, and I called several different outlets, only to find there was nothing. There was barely, you know, there were things for veterans, and some of those were still fledgling projects. There was nothing that addressed the families. And I'd like to hear that, you know, maybe what your thoughts are on that, because we're in some ways beyond their fellow soldiers. We're the next line. We're the next line of defense for their mental and emotional well-being. And we certainly want to help our loved ones, but the resources just don't seem to be there. And I can take any comments off the air. Thank you so much.
Elena, thanks for your question. David Morris?
Well, that's a tricky couple questions to address. I would say at the outset, though, I mean, that's sort of one of the problems that I addressed earlier, is that PTSD is largely treated as a medical condition. So when a layperson from the community, a concerned family member, comes into what is in essence a hospital, you know, the psychiatric establishment doesn't really know what to do with them. They are unprofessional in their terms. They're untrained, and so they don't have – there is not a role for these people traditionally in the VA psychiatric establishment, and that sort of speaks to the point of how unusual it is that we have treated PTSD in the same manner that, you know, very similar manner to how we might treat strep throat, as something to be quarantined and treated, and, you know, and some sort of treated with some sort of antibiotic. But I would say there are a number, you know, there is all the politics of the VA, and we have a number of reasons to be disappointed with them. But one of the, in my view, one of the most important things you can do as a concerned citizen is, number one, you know, love your veterans and spend time with them and try to understand where they're coming from. That sort of goes without saying. But there are a number of therapeutic modalities and therapies like yoga and transcendental meditation, and a variety of other non-traditional, non-Western therapies that can be extraordinarily helpful for PTSD. And so, you know, a friend of mine who I interviewed for the book, she's always been concerned and interested in PTSD, and so she has volunteered her time as a yoga instructor at a local vet center in San Diego. So that is, and the veteran centers are these retail style counseling centers, which are part of the VA, but they're also kind of on their own. They're semi-autonomous, and you can go, and they do take volunteers, and you can volunteer there. And yoga and Tai Chi and these other non-Western mindfulness therapies are incredibly powerful. And, you know, I think, you know, in your average American city, you know, I think many of us know yoga instructors and know people that have this background. That can be a way that is, you know, yoga is a very common, you know, part of our lives now, and that's one way that you can get connected to the vets community. And you could also volunteer. There's the Wounded Warrior Project, which is an outstanding charity. There are a number of great charities out there that are doing work, and you can volunteer your time that way.
Thanks so much for the call, Elena. Let's go to Fish Creek. Elizabeth is waiting. Elizabeth, good afternoon.
Hi. Like the last caller, I'm a child of a Vietnam vet and grew up with a deep sense that his demons were never exorcised. I'm also an herbalist, and I work as an ethnobotanist, and that work has made me acutely aware of the issue that it's just the medicalization of the treatment of PTSD, which is, it's never going to get us all the way there. Certainly, I'm deeply aware that my father's crisis was spiritual in nature, and there's really not that much that you can do from the direction that we attempt to address it, as far as I'm concerned. I love your discussion of ritual. I know that ancient cultures heavily relied on ritual when we had soldiers coming back, and a lot of it had to do with reintegrating into the tribe. They weren't allowed to reintegrate into the tribe in many cultures until they went through a process of what they believed was bringing back their humanity. A lot of them felt that they had put themselves in an animal space and that their humanity was sort of on the shelf until they ritually recovered it. And also, the primary traditional use of psychoactive plants was often specifically for processing these kinds of traumas. And I know that there's a fair amount of research right now, at least in some circles, into how to possibly reintegrate use of some of these psychoactive medicines. I'm wondering if that's something that you've looked at or explored.
Elizabeth, thanks for the call. What about it? Are we looking at psychoactive plants? What kind of treatments are we employing at the moment? David Morris?
Just to answer what I believe was her first question, there is, in terms of separating returning warriors from the large body of the tribe, that was something that you see even in the Old Testament, in the Bible. In the book of Numbers, warriors returning from battle are commanded to remain outside the walls of the camp for 30 days as a way of ritually cleansing before they are returned back to mainstream Israel, Israelite society at that point. So that is sort of a part. The idea of some sort of warrior transition needing to happen is very old. In terms of psychoactive drugs and other botanical interventions for PTSD, I think they offer a lot of promise. It's controversial, and it's difficult to fully explain in mixed company, but the idea of marijuana and MDMA have been explored. There's a Canadian researcher exploring the use of a psychoactive drug, MDMA, which is what we call ecstasy. It's a strange thing to argue, but those psychoactive drugs like that have a very long history. It's not something that was invented in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. Psychoactive drugs have always played what they call entheogens, have always played a large role in ritual, pagan shamanistic rituals in terms of, and I argue in the book that the war space and the trauma space is in essence an underworld of trauma. And the idea of taking one of these drugs, which are largely illegal, and I'm not recommending them, the idea of taking these drugs and using them to enter a mystical space and address and confront demons is a way that cultures have addressed trauma for millennia. So it's one of the ways that, if you look at what we do that's different than what the ancients did, as the caller just pointed out, one thing that the ancients did in abundance was enter a mystical state and address the demons of war and the demons of trauma. And science, it's just very hard to get the VA to, because the science behind it is new and it's controversial, it's very difficult to get a very secular, large bureaucracy like the VA to even consider that as an option.
They have to answer to Congress, and we didn't even get to what's going on in Congress right now. And probably don't have time, but we had a caller. We don't have time to take the call, but the question is, what do you have in terms of advice? We've only got about a minute left. What does the VA need to do? What do you want VA health providers to do differently that they're not doing now?
The VA has has spent a lot of money on these mass-produced one-size-fits-all therapies like prolonged exposure and cognitive processing therapy, which are shown to be effective in about 60% of cases. However, the VA has for a long period of time divested and not spent as much time training individual therapists in the art of therapy. And the idea of the days of having a one-on-one relationship with a therapist in a long-term setting, which most people think of when they think of therapy, that is incredibly rare in the VA because they're trying to get therapy out to millions of veterans, as many as they can. But the personalized rapport and artful therapeutic modalities and those sorts of settings are really far rarer than they used to be. So I think we need to train more psychiatrists and psychologists. That was one of the things that was included in the Clay Hunt Suicide Prevention Act, which finally passed the Senate, was to give college credit to help pay the loans of clinical psychologists help pay off their student loans to get more of them working for the VA. But I think the VA, as we've alluded to, they need to spend more money, research, and resources on non-Western unconventional therapies like yoga and mindfulness therapies. They need to spend, they need to think about less Western, more unconventional therapies and pay for them.
In the meantime, we lose another veteran to suicide every 65 minutes, according to the Veterans Administration. David Morris, thanks for your book and thanks for your time this afternoon. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, John. Good to be here.
David Morris, author of The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. He tells the story of PTSD. You heard it here. If you'd like to listen to it again, it's online at WPR.org. Scott Myers produced this hour of programming and handled on-air production along with Lisa Nalbandian and KP Whaley. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR.